Join me, Rick Howe, on Island Music for the finest in ska, rocksteady, roots reggae, dub and sizzling dancehall, and all the hottest releases from around the Pacific.
Hi, I'm Ronnie Kareni from Sorong Samurai, and you're listening to Island Music.
Hi everyone, my name is Tierney from Te Tangi o Te Kara, and you're listening to Island Music.
Search up ABC Island Music to listen online or find it on the ABC Listen app.
This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning, Talofa, Yan Ravinaka, and good morning. You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Belinda Cora, broadcasting from the heart of Papua New Guinea's capital city, Port Moresby, the land of the Motu and Koitabu people. Today on the show, what is the purpose of polygamy in PNG society, and is removing it the answer to reducing violence against women? We take a look at actions or reactions towards the Prime Minister's intention to outlaw this practice.
Sometimes we take our PNG way out of proportion. Maybe it's about time we look at polygamy in its fullest sense. What relevance is it saving our country today?
Tributes pour in as the Pacific journalism community mourn the loss of one of their own.
Everyone said you got to talk to Dan. He's the guy who knows the region really well, but he's just also the guy that has guts and everyone likes.
We'll have those stories and more coming up on Pacific Beat. But first, Samoa's Prime Minister Laulia Mle Malitoa Pola Taivao Fossi Schmidt is scheduled to appear in court this morning alongside five core defendants on conspiracy charges. A verdict on this long-running case is expected today after multiple delays. Joining us this morning from Samoa's capital, Apia, for more details on this story is ABC's reporter Adele Fruin. Good morning, sister, and thanks for joining us.
Tala Falava Belinda, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Now let's get straight into it. Adele, what are the charges Samoa's Prime Minister is currently faced with, and what is this case about?
Yes, Samoa's Prime Minister Laulia Malitoa Pola Taivao Fossi Schmidt is currently facing 16 criminal charges. However, for the particular case he will be appearing later today in court is on four joint charges with five co-defendants. He was charged with allegedly attempting to pervert the course of justice and conspiracy to commit an offence. Now, a verdict will be called out later today, which we hope will actually happen because we've experienced so many delays so far.
Why has the court verdict been delayed multiple times?
Now, the court has delayed delivering its verdict because the presiding judge requested for more time. She explained to the co-defendants and prosecution that her decision was not yet complete. She also apologized for the delay and asked for prayers. You know, this is noting the heavy responsibility of completing her judgment. And despite the delays, crowds of FAR supporters rallied at the court to support its leader. You will find them all wearing red, basically. So, yeah, I assume that will also happen today, yeah.
What led to Samoa's Deputy Prime Minister losing his seat earlier this week?
Yes, Samoa's Deputy Prime Minister lost his seat because the electoral court ruled he was involved in bribery. He was at the centre, basically. The case centred on a 150 payment made to a voter just hours before polling, which his rival argued influenced the vote. The court ruled that this constituted bribery through the actions of his agent and under Section 116 of the Electoral Act 2019 declared his election seat void, basically. Yeah.
Have either the Deputy Prime Minister or Prime Minister Lauli commented on this issue?
Yes. While the Samoa's Deputy Prime Minister took to social media, he hasn't spoken to any of the media as of yet. He was acknowledging the support from families, constituencies, and he even thanked Prime Minister Laulima Manitou for their support. Now, Prime Minister Laulil Malietor said he feels for Toi Lupe, or our Deputy Prime Minister, and despite being sad about the loss of one of their party members, he respects the decision from the court.
So how is the general public feeling right now, you know, about the governance and, of course, accountability in Samoa as we head into court today?
Well, there's been mixed reactions. While it's important to note that Samoa's Prime Minister, Laulil Malietoa, has a great number of followers locally and abroad. So they're all rooting to support him while he goes through his court cases, basically. But there's also some members of the public who have expressed their anticipation for this much-awaited verdict. So I guess we'll find out later today what will happen. So, yeah.
We'll leave it there. Adele, thank you for talking to us this morning.
Amazing. Thank you, Valinda.
That's ABC's reporter in Samoa, Adele Frewen. Adele will be keeping an eye on the court ruling and will update us here on Pacific Beat. The Pacific journalism community is mourning the death of respected Vanuatu journalist Dan McGarry. McGarry died from heart complications in hospital in Brisbane on Wednesday at the age of 62. Originally from Canada, he moved to Vanuatu 2 decades ago, fell in love with the country and started working at the Vanuatu Daily Post. McGarry came to journalism later in life and became known for his fearless reporting on corruption, a stance that regularly earned him the ire of those in power in Port Vila. Later, he moved to the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project as investigative editor when it started up an operation in the Pacific. The project's Pacific editor, Aubrey Belford, says McGarry will be sorely missed.
Everyone's pretty cut up about this. Dan was really an essential part of OCCRP's team in the Pacific and just in part of the wider journalism civil society community in the Pacific. So, I mean, we're pretty upset, and there's just been tributes pouring in from everywhere, which has been shocking in a really good way. Dan was just, firstly, he was someone who just loved the Pacific. He moved about 2 decades ago to Vanuatu. He's originally from Canada. He was living in the Arctic, if you could believe it, before that. And so just decided he wanted the complete opposite and just absolutely loved the region, loved Vanuatu, became a citizen of Vanuatu, not just on paper, but really in his heart. You know, he built a family in Vanuatu. He was just very, very dedicated to the work, very, very dedicated to the public interest, always wanting to expose wrongdoing and really willing to stand up to people in a place where it's really quite difficult to do that sometimes.
One of the many things that amazed me about Dan was that he came to journalism later in life, but he was a natural. He just had this natural curiosity to know how, why things were happening, what was going on behind the scenes.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, Dan's background, he was a tech guy. You know, he used to be in the tech industry and he was an amateur actor. He was a bit of a gadfly, like in a good way, jack of all trades. And, you know, he just seemed to end up in journalism because, you know, he was there and he cared. He just always had a sense of right and wrong and the things that needed to be exposed. And there's a whole other story for another day about why he left the Arctic into the Pacific, but that involved him, again, being in a really small place and deciding that he couldn't, you know, look away when something bad was happening. So he just had that in him, and I think that's the essence of journalism.
Now, he went to the OCCRP after being at the Vanuatu Daily Post. What did he bring to your organisation?
I mean, the first thing he brought was fearlessness. You know, I mean, you would know very well that when he was at the Daily Post, he faced some real bad pushback for his work and, you know, couldn't even be in the country for a long time. And so when I was trying to set up our investigative journalism in the region, just everyone said, you got to talk to Dan. He's the guy who knows the region really well, but he's just also the guy that has guts and everyone likes. So he really brought this depth of knowledge about the region and contacts and just the universal respect of people. You know, we would be taken seriously as a new media organization, and journalists would want to work with us because Dan was there and they knew Dan and they respected Dan.
One of the great things about Dan was the way he interacted with people. You guys work with a lot of independent organizations around the region. What was Dan like working with them, and what did they think about working with Dan?
He was someone who really took to living in the Pacific and in Vanuatu culture, and understood, you know, how to live in the Pacific and how to talk to people and how to get things done. So Pacific journalists really liked working with him because he wasn't, you know, just some arrogant outsider who comes in and thinks he knows better than everyone. He really listened. He was very, very patient. Really, you know, had a deep understanding, particularly of Melanesian culture. And so he was just someone who could work really effectively in the region.
Pacific editor for the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project, Aubrey Belfort, speaking to Liam Fox. Polygamy has deep roots in parts of Papua New Guinea, but the Prime Minister, James Morape, says the tradition is being twisted and is now fueling family breakdown and violence. He wants reform, even changes to the constitution, but critics say you can't legislate culture, and banning polygamy won't solve violence against women. Polygamy is traditionally practiced across parts of Papua New Guinea, but Prime Minister James Morape says the practice is being abused in modern times.
A person that has more than one or two or three or four wives is not able to manage his family base well, and the person goes to a society that today many kids unmanaged, running around, doing almost nothing but havoc to our society.
PNG's Prime Minister says the traditional practice of a man having multiple wives is undermining women's safety. Mr. Morape says a legal reform is needed to address the problem, and a solution could mean constitutional changes.
May go against our fifth. May go against our fifth constitutional preamble that says PNG ways. But sometimes we take our PNG way out of proportion. Maybe it's about time we look at polygamy in its fullest sense. What relevance is it saving our country today?
But one political expert believes the Prime Minister is taking the wrong approach in dealing with polygamy.
You can't legislate human behavior like marrying more than one wife. Legislation is usually not the answer to cultural issues. Usually it is education.
Dr. Joe Ketan is a Papua New Guinean academic, political scientist and social researcher known for his expertise in electoral politics and tribal dynamics. He says behavioral changes occur over time.
I don't see it eventuating. It might take years of education and years of living within our means for polygamy to go away on its own.
He says polygamy is a custom in the Central Highlands region and was a norm accepted by many until the arrival of missionaries.
They encountered big men who were at the top of the social status with up to 10 wives to wait for the big man. Nowadays, there's no real reason for that except for social status.
And those big men include parliamentarians and leaders across PNG, including within the Prime Minister's own cabinet. One of the four MPs that I reached out to has supported a call by Mr. Morape. He believes the traditional value of polygamy is no longer in existence. Sasindren Mutuvel is the governor for West New Britain province.
While you me respecting culture blow you me, tradition blow you me, where polygamy am once am serving purpose blow.
While we respect our culture and traditions, where polygamy once served the purpose of building clan alliances, protection of widows, or when we try to expand our family size, or even in large scale agriculture farming, at that time it was applicable. But today, in a more modern cash driven PNG, it's very different. years. Now polygamy contributes to family breakdowns, jealousy, neglect, and violence, and information from a demographic and health survey shows clearly that close to 19 to 20%, or 1 in 5 married women in PNG, are in this type of polygamist union.
Close to 19 or 20%, close to 1 in 5.
Patricia Mamele is a human rights defender and works with women in the capital, Port Moresby. She's seen the impact of polygamy on communities.
Comes to family, it actually really breaks families. And then it escalates to like children being on the street, children being exposed to other things surrounding violence, which hasn't been addressed fully.
She says most families in the capital are affected by polygamy. However, banning it isn't the answer to ending violence against women.
The Prime Minister is trying to eradicate polygamy. Is it really going to address the issue? Or it's just a band-aid, sorry to say this, but is it just going to be like a just band-aid?
She's concerned government isn't serious about imposing harsher penalties on perpetrators who commit violence against women. And for the polygamy problem, Patricia Mamele wants better awareness before reforms are implemented.
Have we really gone out to all the provinces, to all the communities? In NCD, have we walked the street? Have we spoken about it? A lot of decisions are made in Parliament, and there's not a lot of awareness about it in the communities. Walk the streets and talk about it. Those politicians sitting there, go to your communities and talk to the people that, you know, we're going to do this in Parliament. Do you want it?
As for political expert Dr. Ketan, he wants deeper research into the practice of polygamy and how it has evolved so there can be better understanding of its place in society and its purpose. That is a story we'll be keeping an eye on as Prime Minister James Marape moves to put reforms in place to make polygamy illegal.
Every game.
What a brilliant try!
Every week.
Beautiful.
Don't miss a minute of the NRL in 2026.
It's game on, baby. This is remarkable footy.
With Andrew Moore and the best team in the business.
What a performance. What a game. What a team.
Hear it all right here.
Unbelievable.
On ABC Radio Australia.
Game, set, bingo.
Your home of rugby league in the Pacific.
Seawater contamination off the coast of Papua New Guinea's New Island province is being described now as not just an environmental crisis, but a social crisis too. For the past 4 months, local communities have reported dead fish washing ashore and a spike in illness linked to contact with the water. The provincial government is trying to identify the source of the contamination, but anthropologist Professor West from the Columbia University in New York, who has decades of experience of working in New Island, says officials should have acted much sooner.
The causes remain unconfirmed, and so samples of the water and I believe the fish tissues have been sent out to laboratories to do testing to see what's causing it. What's happening in New Ireland is devastating. But for me, these are not the kind of abstract communities that we hear some international activists talking about. But these are places and people that I have longstanding relationships with. And I think it's important for listeners to know that these are people whose lives are deeply tied to the sea as a source of subsistence, sociality, obligation, and history. And to see these fish washing up dead and families left uncertain about the safety of the water and the food they depend on, it's not simply an environmental event. It's a social crisis. And, you know, what I'm thinking most around this is we're seeing once again an international community that seems most capable of paying attention only when damage like this becomes dramatic. It's dramatic enough to command international notice. But communities like the ones that are being affected by this in New Ireland have been living with this kind of long, slow, uneven violence that's produced by climate change and other forms of ecological degradation that are actually generated elsewhere, but born there. And so I think this crisis, whether it has a kind of easily recognizable biological cause like an algae bloom, or a less easily recognizable cause like an algae event combined with runoff from a plantation, this is something that is certainly connected to humans. And it's certainly connected to humans who are consuming in a different part of the world, not the people being directly affected by it in New Ireland.
So communities have been saying they've been waiting for months for water test results. Why do you think there's such a delay?
I don't know. I do know that the samples were sent to two different labs, and I just don't know what's happening. I just don't know what's happening with those labs because I've never worked in biological sample testing before. I don't have any idea how long it takes.
So when communities are forced to stop fishing due to contamination, what are the deeper social and cultural impacts beyond just income?
Well, so it's not just income. These are communities. I believe the number is that over 75% of people living in New Ireland depend on fishing for their livelihood, both for fishing for markets where they might sell the fish, but also for their local sustenance. And so we're talking about creating conditions where people have to go elsewhere to find food for themselves and their families. So that's one kind of social transformation. But also, these are folks that have a really deep spiritual relationship with the sea. And they also have a very deep knowledge of the sea. And these changes that we're seeing are unsettling to people. And the kind of uncertainty is both about the food source that they no longer have access to, but also about the future of their communities. Because if you think about these folks, how do you live in a place where your ancestors have always lived, where the sea has been the source of your sustenance and the source of your kind of social history when the sea is no longer safe?
So how dangerous is it for communities to live with uncertainty, not knowing whether their water is safe or not?
The unsettling nature of this is that people don't know when it's going to end. They don't know where it's going to happen again. They don't know if there's going to be a larger event where all of the fish are unsafe to eat. And this is causing a kind of deep, deep internal turmoil for people. I mean, the sea is life there. The sea is everything. And I think for listeners who don't depend on the sea, thinking about what's the thing that you both depend on for everything that sustains you and your family, and that you depend on as a kind of source for you as a social being, what would it feel like for that to be under a threat? And then think about people having felt this way since this started. And the first I heard about this was in late December. So this has been going on for such a long time. And I'm really worried about the toll that this is taking on people.
Okay. Paige West, Professor of Anthropology at Columbia University in New York, and she was speaking to Leah Lowonbo. Port Moresby residents are fed up with long-running disruptions to the city's water supply. For many, living without a regular water supply has become the new norm, as has missing work and school because taps are running dry. Some people are now buying water from shops along with buckets and other containers to wash and cook. The responsible authority, Water PNG, was recently given a $70 million loan from the Asian Development Bank to expand and modernize water supply and sanitation. I took to the streets of Baroko this week to hear from frustrated residents themselves.
I am working. I am a working mother. I come home from work and I always come home to a house that has no running water, especially in the afternoons. That is a normal for my household lately, or I think since, when can I remember? Since last year, I think the whole of last year was the same thing. It's so difficult to, you know, be able to cook and prepare meals and also be hygienic about it, or be able to clean and do dishes, and, you know, having to fill up containers, buckets to shower with.
We don't have water in the morning, and the kids don't go to school for a couple of days. And we have the plates sitting in the kitchen for days and days, which is very unhygienic. And me not going to work basically affects my job. I'm a person who pays for bills, but I don't get the service that I deserve.
Those of us who are working, we need to wash. Our children need to wash. We need to use the loo. We need to cook properly in the house and move around. And those interruptions in the water that has affected us dramatically. So we're not able to get the proper wash that we need to wash, freshen up to go to work or get, for the children to go to school. I would like to see that our local MP, like Mr. John Koba and Honorable Governor Howard Sparkop, and the State Enterprise Minister William Duma, they need to come down and address this one with the relevant authorities, so we can be able to get a constant water into the city.
I, for the past few days, I haven't been washing and going to school, and sometimes I stay home, which affects my learning. And when we go to school, sometimes we have to fetch water from the drums to flush the toilet, which is kind of annoying. When we come back home, there's still dirty plates on the kitchen, and there's no water to drink and to cook, and we have to buy water from the canteen to wash and cook and sometimes wash the plates. And it's really affecting me as a student.
Those were some Port Moresby residents sharing some of the hardship they've been going through over the past year with limited or no water. Pacific Beat did invite the CEO of Water PNG to come on the show and chat about what his company is doing to get water supply resumed, but he declined my invitation. It's time to take a look at other news-making headlines this week. On the line to help go through the news is Andrew Mullen, the editor of One Talk newspaper, PNG's only talk piece newspaper. Good morning, Andrew, and it's been a big news week.
Yeah, good morning, Belinda. It has been a very interesting week.
The continuous downpour right across the country did not dampen a fiery parliament sitting. One of the big things discussed was the media inquiry report. Andrew, what did you make of this?
I think it's very good for the media industry in the country. It was adopted in parliament in this recent session. There's a lot of things that's coming out from it. A few of those important things. One of them is a legislation to protect not just the industry, but the work of the press, and more importantly, protecting journalists when they're out in the line of duty. It also includes an establishment of a national press union, so that's something we haven't had before in the country, so it should be, hopefully that brings some good incentive for reporters and for the industry.
Thank you, Andrew. I understand that you're also part of the Media Council of Papua New Guinea as One Talk newspaper editor. How has the council reacted to this? It's been a long time coming.
Yeah, I had a word with the president of the Media Council, Mr. Newell Choi. He was happy, but he said it's a good foundation for the industry to build on, and which I think is a good way of seeing this. It's good to also have the support of the Permanent Parliamentary Committee on Communications. They did a good job going around the country, speaking to all the members of the council and getting everyone's views before tabling it in Parliament.
So our next question, one thing that's gone viral is the issue of recruitment from the Defence Force. This was because of a video that went viral showing some recruits during boot camp. A lot of people would be wondering, what is this boot camp? Why did you think this video drove so much conversation?
Yeah, I think it's mainly because of the appearance of the recruits. A few of the recruits, they said they were a certain age, but according to Papua New Guinean views, they looked a bit older. And that's what stirred up all the conversations. It was also defended in Parliament by the Minister for Defence, Dr. Billy Joseph. He said one of them whose age was supposedly 24, according to, you know, the opinions of people, he does not appear to be 24 by PNG standards. So that was a real controversy.
Andrew, I understand that this is not the first time that we've had criticism towards the recruitment of soldiers. Where's the loophole? What have we not been able to effectively address?
I think the main thing is the process, you know, all our government systems, whether it's recruitment or people finishing from work, retiring, there's all those processes. And I think it's important if all our agencies follow those processes. Otherwise, they're always open to criticism of being corrupt or, doing things outside of those processes, which can bring, such a backlash to the different agencies and departments. It makes the country look bad. It makes the government look bad.
And finally, we saw Parliament pass a new vagrancy law. What is this about and what is it for?
The Vagrancy Act was presented in Parliament by the Governor for NCD, Powers Pakop. Its main aim is to control the law and order situation in the country. Governor Pakop came up with that on behalf of NCD, but he said that's also applicable to everywhere else in the country. It has the potential to improve efforts in controlling and mitigating law and order issues, but I think it still needs more work to use it more effectively.
Thanks, Andrew. And I understand that the Wantok newspaper has history with Papua New Guinea since its operation. How old is the newspaper turning this year?
Yeah, the paper has been with the country since before independence. It was established in 1970. This year, in August, it will turn 56. It's a proud history. It has a proud history, long history. We hope more people get to read the paper. Tok Pisin is one of our three major languages. I think it's the one more widely spoken, so we encourage people to read. We say it's the people's language, so look at the Wantok, it's really good.
Andrew, thank you for providing your insight and also a little bit more about Wantok newspaper this morning.
Yeah, no worries, Belinda. Thank you very much.
And that was Andrew Morland, the editor of Wantok newspaper here in Papua New Guinea. You're listening to A Pacific Beat. I'm Belinda Cora, reporting live from Port Moresby, Papua New Guinea. Our top stories so far, Samoa's Prime Minister is scheduled to appear in court this morning alongside five co-defendants on conspiracy charges. What is the purpose of polygamy in PNG society today? We heard from the experts. Tributes pour in as the Pacific journalism community mourn the loss of one of its very own. Still to come, the Solomon Islands men's soccer team are in Jakarta to play in a four-nation FIFA series tournament alongside the host nation Indonesia. And we take a look at rugby union and the Pacifica influence. Those stories coming up in a bit. It's already been a year of milestones for men's soccer in the Pacific with the launch of the OFC Pro League, and there'll be more achieved over the weekend. Solomon Islands are in Jakarta to play in a four-nation FIFA series tournament alongside the host nation Indonesia, St. Kitts and Nevis from the Caribbean, and Bulgaria. Whatever the results, the match against the Eastern European team will be an historic occasion for interim head coach Ben Khan. After leading Solomon Islands into the Pro League top four, he has stepped up at the last minute to take charge of Solomon Islands national team.
Look, with the establishment of Solomon Kings, most of the Federation's resources and energy has gone into getting that off the ground and making sure that the club was off to a good start. So the international window is probably a bit of an afterthought, but it's something that we discussed over the weeks leading in, that it made sense for the majority of the Kings team to roll into the national team, given that they're currently conditioned as professional footballers. And yeah, I agreed to take it for this window.
So to that extent, there are certain advantages, I guess, for you here, in as much as most of the players you're pretty familiar with now. Normally the complaint in Oceania is you don't get time to prepare, but you could argue in this case you've had heaps of time to prepare. Is that a fair way of looking at it?
I think there are definite advantages to it. I think if you speak to most national team coaches around the world, the one thing that they bemoan is a lack of time with their team. So you're absolutely right. We don't have to come into camp and reinvent the wheel. We just continue the momentum and the way of training and the way of playing that we've built over the last few months. However, you know, international football, especially opponents of the calibre of Bulgaria, pose a very different challenge to the type of teams and the style of play that we face in the OFC Pro League. So we'll certainly have to be prepared to adapt and acknowledge the level of opponent that we're going to come up against.
And the chance for Solomon Islands to take on a European team which 30 years ago made the World Cup semi-finals. This is big, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the first ever European opposition that Solomon Islands have faced. So it's a huge milestone, a huge chance for us to have an honest look at where we're at. And it's probably a good marker for us to then set our middle to longer term plan into effect, knowing where we're at compared to the type of teams that we'd like to be playing against more regularly.
How much of an opportunity have you had to gather information about Bulgaria?
As we would with any opponent, as extensive a research and analysis as we can do. We know they've had some difficult results and performances in their recent games, but you know, if you look at the teams they've played against, Spain, Turkey, Georgia, we expect the game to be different to how they've played in their most recent fixtures. We have to respect the level of player they've got, and I'm sure they'll come to try and dominate the game.
It's quite a curious quartet of teams that FIFA have brought together for this mini tournament, in effect. I mean, Bulgaria, yourselves, Indonesia, and then from the Caribbean, St. Kitts and Nevis. It's a strange mix, but I guess, again, it's all experience for Solomon Islands, experience that the team has never really had before.
Yeah, it's a strange mix. It's a great opportunity. You've got four teams from very, very different football cultures. And yeah, it looks exciting. And I think it's probably the reason that FIFA have taken this initiative, is to try and expose smaller nations to bigger nations and different styles of football. And ultimately, it's a wonderful chance for us to learn and gain some valuable experience.
And for you personally, is this essentially an audition, or the fact that you're already in charge of Solomon Kings and Solomon Kings have been doing pretty well as a brand new club? Would you take the job on permanently if offered?
That's something that we have to discuss moving forward. There's a lot of work going on behind the scenes in terms of piecing together a vision and a structure for the future of football in the Solomon Islands, which obviously incorporates the national team and Solomon Kings. But yeah, those plans are still ongoing, and we'll see where it all lands in the coming months.
And I presume a great incentive, if not the greatest incentive, must be the response from the fans that the Kings got playing in Honiara. I mean, to see those crowds turn out in big numbers and love what they saw, that's what the future of football in Oceania is all about, isn't it?
Absolutely. It was very special, and we were all very touched and very honoured to be part of that. And I think that the history of the national team in the Solomon Islands is complex. The relationship with the public hasn't always been great. Kings has done an amazing job as a brand and as an entity to repair some trust in high-level football in the Solomon Islands, and we're hoping to continue the level of commitment that the players have given, the professionalism that supports them, and the way that they've played and the playing style that we've tried to bring to life that's captured the public. And we hope that the positivity extends to the national team.
Ben Khan, interim head coach of Solomon Islands, talking to Richard Ewart on the line from Jakarta, where that historic match against Bulgaria kicks off at 7:30 Honiara time this evening. Before that, at 2 p.m. Noumea time this afternoon, New Caledonia will be taking on Jamaica in the Mexican city of Sepopane in World Cup qualifying playoff. If the team from the Pacific can pull off what would be a shock win, they would go go on to play the Democratic Republic of Congo next week with the prize of a place at the 2026 World Cup finals at stake. Meanwhile, American Samoa's men's team have played their first ever game outside the Pacific against the U.S. Virgin Islands in Puerto Rico as part of the part of another FIFA mini tournament. And while they may have lost 5-2, in the end, Captain Ali Mitchell made sure American Samoa had two moments to remember.
Was that a penalty? The referees had a look and said yes, it was. Oh, and it's a red card as well. Here comes the penalty. Sends the goalkeeper the wrong way, and Ali Mitchell gets American Samoa their first goal. Was a little slip and a chance here for Mitchell. Oh, they've got a second. Well, it was a slip by the substitute, Barch. Don't think they'd had a single shot on target up to that point. But now the captain has added another goal. 2 in 2 minutes. Good finish.
American Samoa will be in action in Puerto Rico again on Saturday at 1 p.m. Pengo Pengo against Pacific rivals Guam. In rugby union, the Pacifica influence on the future direction of the All Blacks will be marked now that head coach Dave Rennie has appointed Tana Omanga as one of his assistants. Rennie himself is of Cook Islands heritage, while Omanga has a Samoan background. Also a former All Blacks captain and the current coach of Moana Pacifica, he says he will use the experience to help rebuild the culture within the national camp.
I think it's things that I've learned in my time in being with the All Blacks and teams that do well. You know, culture's a big thing. And developing that culture that comes from that group and, you know, means something to that organisation, you know, that's important. And you know, I've just taken that, having learned that, and try to pass it on wherever I go and how important that is, as well as what it actually takes to be a professional rugby player. Professionals around habits and behaviours and standards that you live every day. You know, that's what I believe breeds excellence, and that's what you should be searching for. So having been part of the best teams in the world, that's what you learn. And I'm just trying to pass those learnings on into every environment that I'm a part of. But we've got to give respect to what's happening around the world as well and the improvement in teams. So that's something I'm sure that along with the rest of the coaching group and Dave, that's what we'll be working hard towards and seeing, you know, where we can get improvements, where we can just keep growing.
Tana Omanga, who will take over as the All Blacks defense coach at the end of the Super Rugby Pacific season. So for now, he remains in charge of Moana Pacifica, who take on the Highlanders at the North Harbour this evening. And 24 hours later, the Fijian Nrua play the Blues at Eden Park.
Disasters are a reality of life in the Pacific, but so is the strength and resilience of its people. Pacific Prepared shares first-hand stories from communities on the ground, drawing on tradition, culture, and collective wisdom to stay safe and support one another in times of disaster. Pacific Prepared explores how communities are adapting and protecting what matters most. Pacific Prepared, Fridays from 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Yo, Michael Chow, jump in. We're late for work.
Jacob Quiet, whose car is this? So flashy. It's even got digital radio.
Hey, what can I say? Your boy's doing all right.
ABC Radio Australia.
Is that ABC Radio Australia on digital radio?
My guy, I forgot to tell you. We're now broadcasting Pacific voices, stories, and music right across Australia in your car, at home, wherever there's DAB+.
So my auntie in Brisbane can finally stop asking me for streaming instructions?
Exactly. Just tell her to find ABC Radio Australia on digital radio. It's that easy.
And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Time to take a look at our main stories today. It's been quite an eventful week in PNG Parliament as members showed overwhelming support for the most talked about Vagrancy Act. Samoa's Prime Minister is scheduled to appear in court this morning for conspiracy charges. The Pacific journalism community is mourning the death of respected Vanuatu journalist Dan McGarry.
There's just been tributes pouring in from everywhere, which has been shocking in a really good way.
I'm Belinda Cora. I'll be back at the same time next week, Friday, live from Port Moresby. That's at 6 a.m. PNG time. You can also hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia because news is next. And coming up after that is Nija Daily.